Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
The only way to score is, of course, to play with a hand break off.
Hello, I'm Ian Stone. This is Hand Break Off, the Arsenal podcast brought to you by The Athletic. We have a packed podcast this morning, and I'm joined by two of the cognoscenti of the Gooner support, the writer of The Athletic, James McNicholas, and our esteemed producer, Teo Papula, who is stepping in because Arthur Roche is either out on assignment, picking up the latest juicy bit of gossip from Arsenal, or possibly asleep. We're not sure which. Good morning, chaps.
Morning.
Morning, Ian.
Morning.
I was just saying before we went on air that it's fitting, given what happened with the substitutions last night, that we should be waiting for an injection of youthful energy.
Well, we got Tayo instead. You as
kind of Willian in this, which I apologise for.
But I was going to say, this is like actually taking off Saka and bringing on Willian. I can hear the audible groans from the North Bank, and I can only apologise that you've got me today. But I will do my best. I was just trying to think actually about what Arsenal's player manager traditions are like. We didn't think we had any.
No. No. Chelsea had that spell in the 90s where they just kept having them. I don't know if you remember, they had like Hoddle, Hullet and Vieira.
Yeah, that was a good time. I'm going to cast myself in the Dalglish role and see if I can win the double at my first attempt. So let's see.
Well, you haven't set the bar high at all there, Tyre. But that's fine. I should say we're recording this on Friday morning after not a particularly great week. We had that awful display against Liverpool on Sunday, and then the pain of conceding a late goal in the Europa League against Slavia Prague. We'll pick the bones out of that. We've also got Random Ask Generator, and we'll be going through some of the pieces written by, it says, our esteemed guests, but only one of them actually has written a piece. But that's all right. We'll get to that. Before we do that, our opening question. One of the worst moments last night, I think, was Alexandre Lacazette bearing down on goal. I wonder if anyone actually felt confident he was going to bury that. So we were wondering, with that one-on-one, who would you have wanted that to be in an ideal situation? Ex-Arsenal players or even current Arsenal players. Teo, I'm going to start with you.
I think I'd always suggest Ian Wright for this. And I made a piece about Ian Wright earlier on this year, and I was talking to Amy, our regular guest on this, about it. She said that he said to her that people would think that he always scored his one-on-ones, the way people talk about it. But I can't remember him missing. I always remember being super confident about him going through on goal. And he's always talked about how, in training, how David Seaman would tell him where to put the ball, about how keepers weren't set right. So in my head, it's crystallised that Ian Wright never, ever missed a one-on-one. But I would definitely have thought that if he'd robbed a player on the halfway line yesterday and gone through on goal, then we would have been celebrating halfway through.
I would have said so as well. I don't remember him missing many one-on-ones. What he always said to me was, got to work the goalkeeper, Stoney. That's the main thing, work the goalkeeper. If they make a save, nothing you can do about it, but work the keeper. What about you, James?
Yeah, it's a good question. Before I answer it, can I just ask, did either of you, how did you feel when it was Lacazette going through yesterday? Did you think he was going to score, or were you expecting an outcome?
I went and made a cup of tea.
Right.
I so didn't expect him, not for one second, not for one solitary moment, did I think, oh, he's going to bury this. I thought he's going to trip over or someone's going to catch him. So, no, I don't know what you felt.
Well, I thought about this in stages, which is accurate because it seemed to happen in the slowest of installments. First of all, he nicks the ball, and then you think, oh, hello. And then I thought, hold on, he's moving quite slowly. He's not getting away from this guy. And he seemed to think that as well. He seemed to think that he wasn't going to get away. And that is the kind of panicked finish that I've very much seen myself do on a five-a-side pitch when you're going away from goal. I don't think he believed in it as well. But even then, even at that point, I was still super surprised at how bad the finish was.
Mm.
So that being said, James, who would you have chosen?
Well, like Tyo, my first thought was Ian Wright. But for the sake of saying something different, I'm going to say Eduardo da Silva.
Yes, great shout.
He was so clinical in those situations, you know, especially prior to his injury. And I remember a goal, I think it was at Ewood Park against Blackburn, where he went through in similar fashion, and you just were never in any doubt. And what Eduardo understood, that I think Lacazette sort of failed to grasp yesterday, or maybe panicked and overlooked, was that you don't have to find the top corner, you don't have to find the bottom corner, you just have to take it early so the goalkeeper's not set, and hit the area that is behind him. And there was such a huge gulf of goal for Lacazette to hit yesterday. I think the fact that it comes off the woodwork, in a way it does him a favour. It makes it look slightly better than it is, because the actual reality is he's got a big area of the goal to aim at.
The confidence, the lack of confidence going through on goal. He could, you know, you could feel the defender bearing down on him. And I mean, contrast that to the anticipation. I was off the sofa when Pepe was bearing down, because you knew that he knew he had the speed to get the right side of the defender for his goal, and I'm sure we'll come to that. But what a goal it was! But I mentioned that only because of the contrast between him and Lacazette, who at no point felt like he had the confidence. And we never had the confidence in him as well.
There's an interesting stat about Lacazette at the moment, which is that I think of all Arsenal's players, he has the highest shooting percentage accuracy. You know, it's the highest percentage of his shots go on goal. It's 75% in the Premier League. I was told a couple of weeks ago that that's actually the highest total in the Premier League, full stop.
Doesn't make me feel any better, this, by the way.
No. And I think, actually, it's a really interesting figure, because, to me, it's such an outlier, and it's so unusual for a centre forward to have that high shooting accuracy percentage. To me, it suggests he probably doesn't take on enough shots. And I think we see that reflected in his numbers after every game. It suggests that there's kind of a bit of a Goldilocks thing happening with Lacazette, where he'll only take the shot on where it's perfectly set for him. And, you know, yeah, he does work the goalkeeper a lot, but maybe he's not prolific enough within that. It's just a sort of an odd quirk, I think, of his style of play.
Well, two things on that, James. Because yesterday there was a very, very wild slash in the first half, which was a good chance for someone, especially given what you've just said. But the other thing about him not taking enough shots, because also in the first half there was that instant where he picked up the ball off our centre half, or picked up the ball from centre half.
That was surreal, wasn't
bizarre.
It? But I think Granit Xhaka was playing, sort of pressing as the centre forward at the time. Gabriel was still getting back, and Lacazette was genuinely sort of 60 yards deep playing next to Rob Holding. And yeah, I think you'll make a very good point on the air shots. I mean, they don't count towards your shot accuracy percentage, so that would
he's
explain.
He's had a few, though.
But you've got a situation. You've got a situation where he's not taking enough shots, and one of the reasons he's not taking enough shots is because he's got this weird role, hasn't he, where he's the most like what Arteta wants in his number nine.
He's sort of a facilitator, although,
but he's not even that good at that for me. So I'm really struggling. So that's why he's not. That's why he's not in the box. But he's also not doing what you'd expect, say, someone like. And of course, as we know with Theo Walcott, this is called the Theo Walcott syndrome. Is when you don't play, you become much better. But Olivier Giroud looks an even better player than he was for us, now that you see what Lacazette is doing in that position.
Who would you have for Ian going through on goal?
Well, anyone but Lacazette, essentially. Martinelli, without a shadow of a doubt. I'd have Aubameyang, by the way. That's our captain, who was on the bench when that went on. I'd have Theo Walcott doing it. I'd have Francis Jeffers doing it. I'd have absolutely bloody anyone except Lacazette at that point. And I genuinely had no feeling that he was going to score, and I don't think anyone else did. By the way, you can subscribe to The Athletic UK right now for a special price of £3.99 for 6 months. That is 40% off the full price of a subscription. You'll enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as ad-free versions of all our podcasts. So go to theathletic.com/ArsenalPod to take advantage of this special 40% discount. That's theathletic.com/ArsenalPod. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave us a review.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
We were a bit with the handbrake at time.
James, did we underestimate Slavia Prague last night? This is a team that's beaten Rangers and more importantly, I think, beaten Leicester City. Why should we stroll through against them? I mean, are the fan base deluded as to our talent?
I don't think the team or the coach underestimated Slavia Prague. I think there were things we saw in the gameplay that suggested that they were quite prepared or at least wary of what Slavia Prague could do. I think maybe as fans, we underestimate them a little bit. I'm sort of in two minds about this. You know, Slavia Prague, they are a decent team. They are very organised. They press very well. They're a little bit similar to Leeds United in the way that they play. Very intense, man-to-man. They beat Leicester, who are a better side than us. I'm fairly confident in saying that.
Yes.
But by the same token, there is still that supporter part of me that looks at it and goes, well, we are Arsenal. We ought to be better. We're not,
What does that mean, James? What does that mean? We're a mid-table team. I mean, you've written about this. We are a mid-table team. And why should we beat the Czech champions? The simple reason why,
and I know exactly what you mean, and I'm just explaining that this is kind of an internal conflict that I feel. If you ask me for a practical reason, I would say, look at the wage bills. And then you would say, well, one side should absolutely, but Willian accounts for a good chunk of that. But nevertheless, given the expenditure, given the revenue, given the budget of the club, we should be dominating a side with their budget. But, you know, we are a team who aren't playing particularly well at the moment. You're absolutely right about that.
No, I mean, Tayo, we were so passive. I mean, you could have, the first half, you could have just ignored that and started again on half time. I mean, why were we so passive? Why did he send them out with such a negative mindset? Was he wary of letting in an away goal?
I mean, absolutely, that's an issue, and that should be an issue about being wary of an away goal. The question about the passivity of the side has been one that's been. I mean, we could have said this about the Liverpool game 5 days earlier. We could have said that many times over the season. I don't know if the team are going out with a head full of instructions that might be too much for them. There is a question about whether there's the right squad for the amount of instructions or to play the way that Mikel Arteta wants to play. But we haven't started I can't remember the last time that we started strongly.
Wolves was a very strong start and an absolutely terrible finish, but we played well in that first 40 minutes.
That's very true. We have our best spell the first 5 minutes after the second half, again and again.
Yeah.
But another reason for that start is that we didn't have our best players out there. And some of that is through injury. Some of that was through selection. Emile Smith Rowe came on and started yesterday and had an energy that we've been lacking in the couple of sparkling moments in the first half came from him. But who would you have expected from the starting lineup yesterday? How do you start any other way apart from cautiously? We set out cautiously. We set out with a right back at left back because that's where their strongest side was, where Slavia Prague's strongest team was. And we started with Willian, which is a more of a kind of conservative option in the first place. And another thing that has also been a feature of Mikel Arteta's Arsenal is that we do think about the opposition a lot more than we as Arsenal fans have been used to, given the previous regimes.
I think that's a fair point, actually, Tyre. And James, if you could pick up on that. Mm. I mean, so many times with Arsene Wenger, we didn't plan for the opposition. The one time when we did, Man City away, we can all name the game when we actually played with a holding midfield player and set up to negate them a little bit rather than just going, oh, we'll just do our thing because we're Arsenal and we're better than everyone else. So I don't mind that thought about the opposition, but I still come back to, it doesn't stir the blood, does it, what we're doing at the moment?
No, and I think it would be, you know, we've said this many times, it would be fascinating to know how fans would be reacting in the ground to the way that Arsenal are playing. You know, when Arsene Wenger was the manager, we used to lament that we didn't prepare enough for the opposition. And it feels like since then, in Unai Emery and Mikel Arteta, we've had guys who are very attentive to that, maybe sometimes at the expense of playing our own game, you know, and asserting our own identity on the opponent. Obviously, it's about striking a balance. And I'd say last night was one of those where it felt that balance wasn't quite right. I think there was real fear about an away goal, fear that was ultimately, you know, came home to roost at the very end in the last 5 minutes. We'll get to that. But I think there was a bit of fear in that. And when you talk about Lacazette being his own half, clearly Arsenal were working on some sort of collective, you know, shape that was concerned about how they were going to play out from the back and trying to press them. But it was all very much geared around the opponent. We talked about Cedric being at left back. That's because the right flank is Slavia's strongest side. We didn't necessarily think, well, how can we push that back? Maybe if we put in a more attack-minded player, Bukayo Saka there, that would help. But there are key absentees too. I don't wish to make excuses. I think Arsenal desperately missed Martin Odegaard last night. I think Arsenal missed David Luiz because a lot of the time it was the centre-halves who had the space, the time on the ball. And I think, you know, if you look at the way Saka was getting in on that right-hand side, if you imagine David Luiz in there instead of Rob Holding, how many more times does that potentially happen? I think maybe quite a few more. So there were absentees.
But Kieran Tierney those absentees, as well.
Kieran Tierney's a massive one. But yes. Some of those were decisions as well. And I do think this conversation around Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang and what exactly Mikel Arteta's plan for this player is, when he approved and pushed for a 3-year contract on the highest salary in the club, and yet there doesn't really appear a coherent strategy for how he's going to deploy him and when he's going to deploy him. I think that's a black mark, really, against the manager.
I mean, this is something we can talk about. Let's talk about Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. He certainly looked up for it when he came on last night. What I found, and I don't know what you think about this, what I found was every time their goalkeeper got the ball, I was desperate to see Aubameyang herring after him, because rather than Xhaka, possibly the slowest player on the pitch, pressing at the top. Because he was bad enough when he wasn't put under pressure, that goalkeeper. You imagine with Aubameyang going through the middle, we might have got something out of that. So Arteta has made a big mistake, has he not, with Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang and the way he's treated him, the way he gave him that large contract, as James said, and then doesn't seem to base the team around him.
It would seem so. I think more so than the pressing angle, you want your best striker getting in and having chances. And he hasn't found
the other day, though, wasn't he, against Liverpool?
He was anonymous the other day, but Lacazette wasn't a great deal better. The other forward options weren't a great deal better. So you're playing someone who... No, Aubameyang is still the best striker at the club. So it did feel like it wasn't entirely a footballing decision. And if it is a footballing decision, it's one of his own making, as James has said, because we haven't found the right position to play our best striker in. And it certainly wasn't on the bench yesterday. So I don't know. You feel like it felt like the start of a long goodbye. When
you did say that on Twitter yesterday, I saw it.
Mostly there's a chance to get an Elliot Gould gif out, and because I'm a big fan of Elliot Gould, and it's one of my favorite films. But it was relevant in the sense that ever since not harking back too much, but you know, dropping your captain for the North London Derby for being late is symptomatic of something else, and it sends out a certain impression to him. And leaving him out for the one big game left that we have this season, next week aside, also seems like it was more than just a tactical decision. There's a problem there, but I'm not going to have a go at him for giving him the contract, because we all wanted him to do that.
No. I think that was absolutely fair enough. We've got a couple of questions from the general public who have written in on Twitter with a few little suggestions. Tony D, Essex Tone, at Essex Tone, asked, Arsenal often play a very pedestrian keep ball style of play. Is this due to Arteta not having the players he wants, or is it the fault of either the players or the manager? And the follow-up question, is it likely to improve once the squad has players that Arteta has bought in? James, it is pedestrian, isn't it?
It is pedestrian at the moment, and you know, how you apportion blame between players and manager is always a difficult one. I think your evaluation of the manager probably depends on how you see the potential of this group. I think often my biggest emotion when Arsenal perform badly at the moment, when my main reaction to it is my surprise at people's surprise. I feel like the gap between our best and worst performances in the course of this season isn't that enormous. And actually, we characterise the team as inconsistent, but there is actually a certain degree of consistency about what they produce, in that it's pretty average. And I think of what this group achieved under the previous manager, Unai Emery, and I struggle to say that we're going backwards. But it's also fair to question, I think, whether we're going forwards quickly enough today in the light of yesterday's performance and the Liverpool performance. You know, it doesn't feel like it.
I mean, just following on from that then, Tom Rainsley Hughes wrote to us, is Arteta getting an easier ride from the fans and pundits because he's an ex-player? And he said, I have to believe that if this season was being managed by Emery, then there would be more talk of him being fired rather than trusting the process. I think that's a fair point, is it not, Tyo?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's an element of a holding pattern this season anyway, not least because none of us have been in the ground. So it doesn't quite feel as real or as urgent as it would if the season was in full flow. I do think it's a fair point about Emery, but I think that's been the case for a while. But I think there's something about being a fan, in the same sense that Dave Meldrum tweeted me this morning to say, when do we get to criticise Thomas Partey, for example? If Xhaka had been playing as poorly as he'd been, then he'd have been mercilessly rounded on. Now, I see the point that he's trying to make. It's because we want Arteta to do well. It's because we've had the Emery experiment and we want Arteta to do well. And if you are a fan favourite, then you get more time. The cracks are beginning to show. I think there's enough dissenting voices now who are beginning to wonder whether the process is actually what that actually means. We don't seem, as James said, we don't seem to be going forward in some ways. So I think it's perfectly fair to criticise certain aspects of Arteta's play. I think the fact that he is passive towards and is too aware of the opposition is a thing. I think he does make his substitutions too late.
Yep.
I do think that there's a issue with his non-negotiables and how the squad are reacting to them, rightly or wrongly, whoever's to blame there or not. But it's not really about blame anymore, is it? It's about trying to find a way to work with modern players and modern management in a way that, for example, the players seem to love Jurgen Klopp, or the way that they love Nuno at Wolves.
Neither team of which, by the way, are doing that well at the moment. But I totally take your point, Tayo. I wanted to talk, you mentioned the subs there. There's a couple of things I wanted to ask you, James. Bringing on the subs so late, I mean, you can almost set your watch after 70 minutes. I mean, Arsene Wenger used to be, what, 67 to 73, I think it was. Mm-hmm. But there was certainly a case for making changes before half time, or certainly 2 minutes into the second half. He waited until the 70th minute. I thought there was a certain pointed thing about bringing on Martinelli before he brought Aubameyang on. And also, I wanted to ask you, I know it's a separate thing, but their goal started by Cedric turning back towards his own goal and putting Gabriel in trouble, which led to a throw, which led to a corner, which led to their goal. It's a negativity. It's a passivity. It's that word again. I can't really think of another word where he's not affecting the game quickly enough, and the players are nervous.
Yeah, I mean, on the substitutions point, I think it was pretty clear from early in the first half that there was space in behind the Slavia defence. You know, Saka was the guy getting into it, but as soon as we added Martinelli or Aubameyang or potentially Pepe, we had another way to go, another route to go, and Lacazette's not that guy. You know, Willian's not that guy who's going to run in behind, it seems, especially playing from the left. So I did find it curious that we wait so long to introduce those players. I mean, had they come on, you know, even 10 minutes earlier, it might have really swung the tie in Arsenal's favour. All that said, as frustrating as the first 77 minutes was in this game, we do eventually get the goal, and it's a really brilliant goal.
Yeah.
Aubameyang, I think, does the sort of work there that he's often criticised for not doing. You know, that's what you would expect to see Lacazette picked for, to kind of win the ball and play him in. And Pepe's finish, I think he shows what Saka still has to learn, which is that icy coolness in front of goal. And, I mean, Lacazette should watch that finish. It's not about how clean he strikes the ball. It's just about having that deft touch to put it beyond the goalkeeper. And I feel desperately sorry for Pepe, by the way, because I feel like every time he has a really good breakthrough moment, Arsenal turn around and shoot themselves in the foot. So they keep getting overlooked. But to come on to your second question about Cedric, there's a screen grab doing the rounds on social media. I'm sure everybody's seen it, of 92 minutes on the clock. Cedric's got the ball in the left back position. Plenty of green grass ahead of him. All he's got to do is drive into that. Instead, he turns around, probably partly to do with the fact that he's playing on the wrong side, goes on his preferred right foot, plays it back to Gabriel. Gabriel takes a heavy touch. We lose the ball and we go on to concede the goal. I mean, as bad as we were for 77 minutes, conceding having taken the lead, I think is really, I want to say almost unforgivable. It's a criminal thing to do, because the difference in what it means to win this match 1-0 to 1-1 due to the weight of the away goal is absolutely huge.
It's very easy today, and we've done it, and so has everyone else, to pile in on the manager. But that's a bad, I mean, that's just dumbass football.
Bad decision on the part of him.
That's bad football. And you could, and I guess a counter argument would be, well, he's making that decision because of, I wonder whether he was making that decision because of a head full of instructions, and Arsenal play a certain way. And we've seen, you know, we saw that rash of goals that we gave away from even more rank defensive errors. And then just talking about personnel, maybe we have an issue there because David Luiz can play the ball a bit better than Gabriel can, than Rob Holding can. But really, that's a bad mistake or a lack of confidence from Cedric. And
yeah,
there's a reason for that, which is not always the manager's fault, is it?
No, I was just going to say, sales of Just For Men in the Hertfordshire area must be through the roof, because how Mikel Arteta hasn't got a grey hair yet, I don't know.
Yeah, give it another 6 months. Give it another six months. One more question before we move on. Kevin Doherty contacted me on Twitter. Good managers coach players to be better. Klopp, Pep, Rodgers, Dean Smith. He said, not sure which Arsenal players are improving. Some seem to be going backwards. I mean, this comes back to Mikel Arteta. I think some of the younger kids have come in, James, and have done well. But with the senior pros, do you see much improvement from Mikel Arteta's coaching?
It's always difficult to speak in the light of a really poor result and poor week. I think there have actually been improvements. I would say, for example, Granit Xhaka, I think he's actually a better player under Mikel Arteta than he was under either Arsene Wenger or Unai Emery. Not to say he's a perfect player, he's still flawed, but I think he's better than he was. Beyond that, I'm sort of struggling.
Yeah.
You know, I think Rob Holding's had good moments, but yeah, it does get tough. But I think that says maybe more about the team than the individuals. I do wonder to what extent the way the team is set up is enabling some of these individuals to shine.
That's the coach, though, isn't it? And it's interesting enough, James, Bumpy Lanes continued on that theme. Arsenal fans wanted to see more tactics, good coaching. We thought that was the problem, that we had the talent, but the game had moved on and we needed something else to lift that talent higher. Were we mistaken?
About the level of talent that we have within the squad?
Yes. Well, also, is good management more valuable than good coaching?
Well, that's a really interesting question because, I mean, footballers know. Footballers know if a guy can coach. And these Arsenal players, I remain certain, believe that Mikel Arteta can coach. Whether that is the same as management and whether that is enough to get you results. I mean, football is littered with people who are highly successful assistants or training ground coaches who do not make the transition to being the number one guy.
Steve McLaren
is
to give
example,
you one name,
but you know, Brian Kidd. There are so many more people who are brilliant technical thinkers about the game who don't always grasp the wider job. And the thing is, it's possible that Mikel Arteta will be one of those guys. It's the tricky thing is it's sort of early to say, and I know that might sound ludicrous for a guy who's been in the job for, you know, quite a long time at this point, but because it's so early in his managerial career, because there's no history to look back on or draw upon, it's still early days for him. And the question becomes, how long are Arsenal prepared to wait to see if he fulfills the potential he may have? You know, it's part of the beauty of appointing Mikel Arteta is that you can project all these things onto him, that he might be the next Pep Guardiola, that he might be kind of, you know, the love child of Wenger and Pep and have all those attributes and qualities. But if that's the case, like any professional in any job, it's probably going to take more than 2 years for that all to come to the fore. And are Arsenal prepared to be the guinea pig in that situation?
That kind of rounds it, James, though, back to the question about expectations for Arsenal and whether we trust the process whether we trust the process or not.
Yeah.
You know, there isn't a blueprint now for a 8 to 10 year cycle for a manager, an 8 or 10 year running track for a manager to warm up on. Do you know what I mean?
No.
And we're asking, because we saw that with the age that we are and the experience that we've had with Sir Alex Ferguson and our own Arsene Wenger, even, you know, I mean, we grew up in an era of, you know, Sam Allardyce was at a club for a certain amount of time. David mm-hmm. Moyes was at a club for a certain amount of time. Nobody is anymore. Nobody well,
certainly
is.
Not.
And you are asking, someone to be a coach, great. But there does seem to be an issue where, if the coach isn't getting his instructions across, then that's where the cross between a coach and a manager needs to be a lot more synergized, basically. Because I think there's a reason why we expect more from these players, because we're looking at these technically adept players and then getting very frustrated when they don't seem to be playing to what we expect their ability to be. So then you'll start asking questions about, and if Mikel Arteta is this coach that he's supposed to be, then why isn't he getting that out of the players? Why is he saying the same things over and over again? Why are we making the same mistakes over and over again? It's maddening.
One more question, which both of you can answer. But James, you were jokingly tweeting that our game was really the big game of the week when they were BT Sport were trailing it during the PSG versus Bayern Munich game, which, by the way, is worth watching. I mean, I watched that game and I thought to myself, I'm not sure a single Arsenal player would get in either of these teams. We are miles behind. And as much as Tayo talks about the technical ability of our players, I don't think any of the players on the pitch, Saka would be a squad player for Bayern Munich or PSG, but I don't think anyone else would get near that team, would they? And we have fallen so far behind now. Do you have faith that we can get back to that level?
Well, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because the end game, the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, is getting back in the Champions League. But I, like you, I watched that game and thought, yeah, absolutely murdered in that competition. I mean,
killed.
I don't know what people's expectations would be if we got back into the group stage. But I suspect the best we could probably hope for is third place finish in the group and nip back into the Europa League.
That's where we're at. We beat Slavia Prague. They were showing it before the game. We beat Slavia Prague 7-0 at home in the Champions League the last time they came to the Emirates.
Game.
Yes. And Cesc Fabregas was playing, and what a player he was. And Emmanuel Adebayor, and we may have hated him, but he's better than any forward we've got right now, as far as I can tell. And we are so, so far behind. Tim Stillman wrote a very interesting blog about rebuilding the club. Do either of you think that the guys we've got are capable of doing that job?
I saw something quite funny there. It made me laugh anyway the other day. We are now a sleeping giant.
Yeah, comatose we are.
Arguably. But the big question I'm interested in, I know Amy doesn't think that there's money to be spent, but we can't do any of that rebuilding any further if we're as cash-strapped as we very much might be. After a couple of years of the pandemic, after the fact that we're falling further and further away from the Champions League that we mentioned, so is there money to rebuild, or are we stuck in this kind of cycle now? So it'd be quite interesting to see what happens if we can make the replacements. It's easy for us to sit here and say we need an upgrade in centre-forward, for example, but where's the money coming from? So therefore, I don't know if it's possible to answer your question with anything more than fan optimism, Ian.
I think that's a great point. Yeah, and can I just say, I think that is the thing that maybe tempers my expectations more than anything else, because Arsenal are in a position where, as Josh Kroenke has said, they're a Europa League club playing Champions League wages. The longer they stay out of the Champions League, the longer that's going to be the case, the more money they're going to continue to hemorrhage, essentially. So we can all look at it now and say changes need to be made. But all those changes, as Ty says, cost. And the prospect of us doing that this summer with the year that they've had financially and with the owners that we have, and we know about their lack of record of putting money into the club, I think we have to be realistic about how much better it can get in the space of a few months.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
We were a bit with the handbrake at the time.
Ian Stone here with James McNicholas, Tayo Papula, and now Art De Roche, who's joined us. Hello, Art.
Hi, guys.
Hello. Almost Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang levels of timekeeping here. Excellent work. Art is actually sitting. He's doing this sitting in his Ferrari. He's just revving it up outside. He's going to drive away straight after the game, straight after the pod, I imagine. Art, you wrote a piece. You'd be fine. I tell you what, if this was Mikel Arteta running this podcast, you'd be in a lot of trouble. You'd be benched for the next three. Art, you wrote a piece about the game last night. Arsenal's lack of control, sloppy passing and late Arteta subs undermined good parts of their game. We've talked quite a lot about the substitutions. The tactical, the way that Arsenal set up tactically, it didn't seem to produce a lot in the first half. It got a bit better once the subs came on, but we've mentioned the word passivity more than once today. Is that how you saw it?
Yeah, I think when I was discussing, say, the tactical aspect of that game last night, it was more looking at what Arsenal were doing without the ball. And again, that probably shows you what it was like at the game last night. Of course, you guys could see it over the TV. Arsenal didn't really have much control when they had the ball. But what was standing out most to me was whenever the ball went back to the Slavia Prague goalkeeper, there were four Arsenal players almost in a wall on the edge of their box, almost daring him to make a pass. And there were times where that worked well. And I think what was maybe where they missed the trick, was maybe not putting as much pressure on him directly to force him into making those errors. Because there were times where, say they did go into that pressing routine, they'd wait on the edge of the Slavia box and the goalkeeper would maybe kick the ball out of play or make a dodgy pass. And those are the moments I feel where I guess passivity is maybe the word, but where Arsenal could have been a bit more adventurous in that side of the game. But also in terms of when they did have the ball, it seemed like from watching from the press box, there was a lot of movement on the left-hand side. So Emile Smith Rowe and Willian were interchanging a lot, but the ball just wasn't coming to them. A lot of focus was on the right-hand side instead, with Rob Holding and Bukayo Saka, and Thomas Partey wasn't really assisting them as much as usual. And I think that really took its toll, because even though Rob Holding was able to create a really good chance for Saka in the first half, it wasn't often enough. And that's where I think, like myself and you guys, probably saw that maybe passive nature that really took its toll over the course of the game.
Can I just ask something? Because you, James, and you, Art, have been in the stadium certainly more than the rest of us. What was it like last night, Art? What was it like on the pitch? Was there an energy from the players at the start of the game? Was there where did that passivity come from? You can perceive that all the time through the TV, but is there a nervous energy or lack of energy in the ground on the players at the time? And what is the effect still of no fans being in there on that?
I think especially when Arsenal were going through that terrible spell in November, December, it felt like rather than going into games and having that excitement, once the game had started, it almost felt like it was a countdown, if that makes sense. So you almost immediately get that nervous energy because you're conscious of how much time is left. And I think when Arsenal start games slowly, that effect becomes even more evident. And that was the case last night, I do feel, because even though, say, Bukayo Saka had his chance and Lacazette also in the second half, there were moments throughout the game where Slavia Prague had their moments too. And that's when I think the element of being conscious of time comes into play. And I think that's where, I guess, the nervous energy comes in a bit more. But then when you look at games where Arsenal have performed much better, I think you lose track of that time element, and players are maybe a bit more free to do what they actually want to do. I mean, even in the second half, before the substitutions were made, there were a few instances where, say, Willian hits a simple pass straight out of play. There are a few other moments where players just make simple mistakes, and it felt like they were almost thinking too much about what they were going to do. Whereas I'm not sure that would have been the case if, say, they had gone ahead earlier and then had a platform to build off. But that's kind of how I put it into words. I'm not sure if James feels different.
Well, I want to come to James, because I know you wrote a piece as well about last night with Amy. One of the things, one of the people you talked about who we haven't really mentioned much, we missed him on Sunday against Liverpool, and we also missed him last night, was David Luiz, and it's his passing that opens the game up a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, Art talked about that. The right-hand side, clearly Saka had the better of their fullback. He had the timing, he had the speed to get him behind there. But that wasn't as joined up a flank as it should have been, and part of that was down to the absence of Luiz. I think a lot of it is down to the absence of Martin Odegaard as well, who's a guy who's comfortable drifting out to that flank. And, you know, Thomas Partey didn't have his best game in Arsenal shirt by any measure at all, really. But I think Odegaard's a really important player for him. They combine pretty well usually. He finds him frequently. So his absence there was a factor. I just think the Luiz situation is kind of a perfect encapsulation of Arsenal and where they are at this point. You know, I think there is a feeling and an understandable feeling about players like Luiz and maybe to an extent Xhaka that they're sort of not really good enough for Arsenal. But it sort of reminds me of a guy down a pub, you know, sort of complaining about, I don't know, his misses, and you feel like turning around and saying, have you had a look at yourself? I mean, Arsenal are sort of pretty dependent on these players, and in their absence, you feel it very keenly. And there's a kind of irony in Arsenal becoming entirely dependent on two fairly unreliable players. But that is kind of the encapsulation of where we are at the present time. And it's a particularly interesting discussion, given that a decision about David Luiz's contract is imminent, you know?
Well, where we also are at the moment is that when Kieran Tierney is injured, we have no replacement for him. And one of the things you talked about was Cedric having, I mean, we mentioned it before you got here, Cedric having to turn back because he's on his wrong foot. Arsenal, a club the size of Arsenal, should not be in a position where we are so reliant on two or three players.
No, they shouldn't. And I think what was something that I noticed before kickoff was, so obviously Miguel Aziz was there, but he's a central midfielder. But also Joel Lopez, the under-23s left back, was on the bench actually for the game. So I think even though Cedric started there, I do wonder if there will be a point in the next couple of weeks where Mikel Arteta does feel the need to maybe put a left-footed player back at left-back. Obviously, I think Bukayo Saka would probably be the first choice for that.
Yes.
But then you kind of risk losing what he brings on the right. That being said, I do feel that, especially since the turn of the year, Nicola Pepe has proven that he can provide maybe not the same type of play as Saka from the right, but he can still be very effective off the right. He showed that last night with his goal, but he's also proven that coming off the bench against Tottenham to play the pass for the penalty, and against West Ham to assist Lacazette's equaliser, as well as performing quite well when he started against Leicester in February. And I think if Mikel Arteta does decide to move Bukayo Saka back to left back, then there shouldn't be too much of a problem, because Nicola Pepe has shown over recent weeks that he can take that role seriously and perform to a respectable degree. And if Arsenal are lacking that natural left footer at left back, then it just offsets the whole balance of the team, really. And I think that's something, maybe it wasn't as crucial in the first leg because there is still the second leg to play, but next Thursday especially, Mikel Arteta does have to get that decision right.
Four games until we're back in the Champions League, lads. Four games. Very, very excited at the prospect. Already booked my seat on the sofa. Assuming, I don't know, we might be allowed back in the grounds, to be honest with you. I can't wait to see us get absolutely thrashed by Galatasaray or someone. Anyway, let's Let's do something happier times. Tao, our producer, and Erst, and now sometime presenter on this show. We were talking about the random ask generator, or rather, he tweeted about a player that he particularly loved, and I said we should do him for random ask generator. So I should, you know, it's a slight disclosure here that I have had advance notice of who this is. But the random ask generator this week has come up with a brilliant Kanu. Tay, I'm going to come to you first, just because you actually tweeted about Kanu and what a wonderful player he was. Try and keep this to one anecdote for no longer than about half an hour, okay, if you could possibly manage.
I have a particular love for Kanu as he's as a Nigerian. And I tweeted about an Ajax moment which happened on this day with some control, some kind of time-defying control. But I'm going to start off this random mask generator with one of my favourite moments which happened in Europe, and we've mentioned it before because it is one of my favourite goals, but not by Thierry Henry or Ian Wright. It is the Juju goal, as I call it, which is Kanu against Deportivo La Coruña, where he just, with just a... the faintest of swivels of his snake hips, sent the Deportivo goalkeeper one way, and the ball just rolled into the net, and he didn't even have to touch it. And that is just clearly one of my favourite moments from one of my favourite players.
It's lovely. It's a lovely, lovely moment. And what the thing I remember most about it was this 38,000 people at Highbury all laughing, all just actually laughing, going, did that actually happen? You were young, so I'm not sure you have too many particular memories of Kanu, but you obviously saw him play. Anything you'd like to add to this?
He had massive feet, from what I remember. were they size 12s or something like that? Or
15s was the legend. I don't know if it's true.
Really?
But yeah. Size 15 was the tall.
That is one, I think, how skillful he was is probably a surprise given how big his feet were.
Yeah, because you often say, didn't you, good feet for a big man. But nobody ever said that about Kanu because he was
big
so good.
Big feet for a good man. Exactly.
Big feet for a good man, exactly. James, what about you? A Kanu memory?
Oh, I've got so many. I have to say, I wrote about Kanu a couple of weeks ago. We did a series on The Athletic about modern cult heroes. And I said I was going to write about Kanu because he was a player I adored. And you speak about laughing at that goal against Deportivo. Kanu is... the rarest of things, a footballer who did many, many things that I had never seen before and who played football almost like an alien. Like, it was like he had arrived in football without having progressed through, you know, the conventional academy system, and he just thought about the game completely differently. But one of the people I spoke to about him was Lee Dixon, who we all know well. And what struck me about what Lee said was, he was a very spindly looking guy, Kanu, but Lee spoke about how strong he was. And he said he was like he was made of iron. Like his frame, you couldn't get near him. And he used to sort of put his leg between you and the ball. And that was it. It was over. You just couldn't get round him. And I think he spoke about his body being like as hard as steel. And it's interesting because we think of him as a very kind of laid back guy, a very skillful player. But he was also about 6'5". And although lean, seemingly very powerful. So I just think that's an interesting aspect of his game that I hadn't really considered.
Yeah. I mean, the feet must help, mustn't they?
You know, the feet must help.
Just to how solid...
Lee eulogised about Kanu because he basically said, as a defender, he was a dream because you could boot the ball up to him and he'd give you a break. He'd give you a chance to get your breath back because he could hold it and he had the skill, he had the ability. And he said in training, he would do everything he could for the like six-a-side games they play in training to get on Kanu's team just because it made your life so much easier because he would just stand in the middle of the pitch. You could give it to him. He'd hang on to it for 2 or 3 minutes, you know, and just control the game completely. I mean, another goal that obviously lives long in the memory is the one against Middlesbrough where the cross comes in for the right-hand side. I think it's Ray Parlour. And he just sort of does a kind of drag back first time through his legs into the far bottom corner. Again, at that time in England, in the Premier League, you'd never seen anything like that.
I think you'd be surprised to know that Kanu only scored 30 goals for Arsenal.
Wow.
Actually, that doesn't surprise me. Because I'm actually thinking about goals, but it's not about goals for me. It was about the fact that when he got the ball, and James, you of course alluded to this, and Dicko would have thought this as well. He got the ball, and people, You know that scene in Gladiator, right, where Russell Crowe comes out? It's in the Moroccan one, right, in the little gladiatorial thing. And Russell Crowe comes out, and the six guys who are going to try and kill him all take a step back, right, because they have a certain respect. And I feel Kanu made that sort of space on a football field, right? I just feel that he, as soon as he got the ball, nobody dived in because they knew they'd be made to look a fool. So I'm not really thinking so much about goals for Arsenal. I just loved watching him play. And like James said, he looked like he played football at a different pace, a different sort
it's
of game
we
to everyone else.
Have him on the pitch 92nd minute last night. Cedric give him the ball. He just see it out. Luke Young as well. I think did we speak about that on here? Was it
the
Luke
goal,
Young who he destroyed at White Hart Lane, knocked the ball over his head? I mean, the goals are very memorable, which probably makes you think there were more of them. But we can't let this conversation pass without talking about the Chelsea game, right? In the rain, where he turned it round with the hat trick.
Go on then. I think we should talk about the Chelsea game. We were 2-0 down after 75 minutes. Yes.
Kanu started the game, sort of wasn't really in it. 75 minutes. It was a very wet day. The sort of ball was holding up a little bit. And again, he seemed to have that intelligence where he seemed to sort of immediately understand that and how he had to adapt his touch accordingly. He scores a couple of goals, very good goals in themselves. But it's the winner where he kind of, you know, he strides off down the left-hand side. Ed De Hooy does us a favour by charging about 18 yards out of his goal along the touchline. But then he's got the drag back to beat him and an outrageous finish from the most acute of angles, bending it into the far top corner. I mean, it's sort of fairy tale stuff. And he was a kind of fairy tale, ridiculous player. I've never seen a footballer quite like him. And I think, you know, he was sort of unfortunate in a way because he played for Arsenal in a time where we also had Dennis Bergkamp and we also had Thierry Henry. And that probably meant he played a lot less and scored a lot less than he might have otherwise done.
I think that the Chelsea winner, I remember when I first saw it and the second time I saw it, you almost think it was an accident that you know, it was a lucky ricochet that the ball ended up at his feet. But as you say, James, like, he just carried on doing that.
The two centre halves on the line had won the World Cup about 6 months previously, Franck Leboeuf and Marcel Desailly. He didn't do that to just any team. This was Chelsea away, and the two guys were excellent centre-halves, and he made them look like idiots. So I think it's worth bearing in mind how good the opposition was when he did that. You wanted to talk about that Ajax goal. That was what first got me thinking about this conversation. And it was only when I looked at that Ajax goal again that I realised he was in total control of that situation for the whole time.
The Ajax goal is something that he did time and time again, not least in the Olympics in 1996 when Nigeria won the gold and I truly fell in love with him. And the ball comes to his feet in the 88th minute or something like that. And just so often time stopped and therefore it was something that he did. In the same way that you see that like the Messi trademark is the stop, as we've seen ourselves with Almunia falling over and many other better keepers doing it ever since. But stopping the play, stopping time or making things happen at their own pace. And Kanu did that again and again. You did say one anecdote, but just to take away from the love in slightly, another very memorable Arsenal Kanu moment happened against our opponents this weekend, Sheffield United,
which his debut,
which ended up with the match being replayed as he chased down a throw-in, didn't he? Sheffield United were giving... No, we gave the ball back to Sheffield United. He chased the ball down, to which Overmars... across it, but Overmars, who didn't have the excuse of it being his first game and didn't think anything...
Should have known better.
...of putting the ball in the net. But that FA Cup game ended up being replayed.
I always found that strange, by the way, that the idea that, you know, he came from Italy and he'd been playing in Holland previously with Ajax, that in those countries, they just don't give the ball back after an injury. I always found that slightly unusual, but it seemed like a very useful excuse at any rate. But I can't allow conversation of Kanu to pass without talking about, he scored some miraculous goals, but the real miracle was that he had a career. I mean, we signed Kanu, and Arsene Wenger at the press conference spoke about it being a risk, but the talent of the player being worth the risk. I mean, he had a very, very serious heart condition, and it was undetected for most of his young career. He went to Inter Milan, signed for them. That was his big move. You know, he'd had the Olympics that summer, was set to start Serie A. They have a routine series of medicals on the eve of the Italian season that they have to undertake for insurance reasons. And they turn up this heart condition. And Inter were absolutely apoplectic. They couldn't believe it. They said any routine medical exam should have shown you that he had this faulty valve in his heart. And frankly, they considered it very lucky, very fortunate that he had got to that point in his life, I think he was 23 at the time, without dying, without suffering a very serious, serious accident. Then he goes to America, has an operation. Again, at that point, nobody is even able to say whether he'll ever be permitted to return to competition, to ever be permitted to play again. And Kanu's a very religious guy. He put his faith in God. He said, you know, it's in God's hands. And he always had that faith. He always had that conviction. The fact that he mounted the comeback that he did, not only that, went on to play for about another, you know, 15 years. I mean, he was at Portsmouth, God knows how long. He's quite extraordinary. And on top of that, the work he's done with his foundation, the Kanu Heart Foundation, I mean, they've saved thousands of lives. So there is a bigger story here outside of what he achieved in football, which is, I think, all the more special.
You know what? I don't think we can top that, really. Should we get a song before we go? Art, I'm going to come to you first. Do we have a song for just maybe looking at the way Arsenal have been in the last few weeks?
I'm going to go for a bespoke one today, actually. Kanye West, Late, and I think we know why.
I'll be late for that, baby, I wait for that. If you had a taste of that, you probably pay for that. I'm coming in when I feel like to turn this motherfucker up only if it feels right. I'll be late for that, I can't wait for that. I think I was made for that. So I'm coming in when I feel like to turn this motherfucker up only if it feels right.
Fair enough. I'm gonna have Iggy Pop. I'm bored, basically, because I'm a little bit bored with it now. If I'm totally honest with you, I was all about trusting the process, but it's hard to keep that faith. James, Tao, I'll come to you first. Tao,
there's a Marvin Gaye song called "Where Are We Going," produced by the Mazelle Brothers, who I'm a big fan of. So it feels apt. I'm going with Marvin.
James, what about you?
I'm going to go with Trust the Process by... No, there isn't. I was actually thinking along the same lines as Art, but even more melancholic. I actually had Carole King, It's Too Late. But I don't know if we do that to our listeners, because they're feeling sad enough as it is.
Great tune. Yeah. Okay, that's been Handbrake off the Arsenal podcast, brought to you by The Athletic. Thanks to our guest, James McNicholas, Art de Roche, and our producer guest, Tao Papula, as well. We'll be here next week. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Ian Stone. See you soon.